Welcome to Serial City, a podcast of stories, serialized and self-contained. On each show, we welcome guests to complement our day's selection. Serial City is produced by the Midwest Centric Publishing imprint Maintenance Ends. Welcome. Here is Todd Kim. Welcome to the ninth episode of Serial City. Your host is out this time with a case of breakthrough COVID. Go figure. In this episode, we speak with author Amaria Sanchez Pratt. Amaria holds an MFA from the University of Kentucky, where she received the 2018 Nikki Finney Fellowship. Her work can be found in the Anthology of Appalachian Writers, Volume 12. We discovered her in the pages of Story magazine, issue 9. Amaria also treats us to a reading from the first pages of this excellent story, titled Hyde River. This all follows a new, and very brief, installment from Rick Harsh's Smiley Face Killers serial. If you've forgotten where we are exactly in the extemporaneous story, go back to episode 8, time mark 5236, for a little refresher.
After the Christmas and New Year holidays, that's when the surveillance begins. And you will catch them in the act. Spivey is known to be a motorcyclist. For a while, Dale and Florentina had a motorcycle they shared. That was back when they were in college together at Viterbo. And, you know, it was a used old thing and, you know, I guess more or less of a hobby. But, you know, she rode it. You know, she was the type. You know, she delicate as she may look, you know, she would get a kick out of that very impression that she would make. That delicate, beautiful Florentina Bush, you know, going around on a motorcycle. So there you have yet again another element in this. So she's been seen on the motorcycle with Spivey McNaughton by no less a sleuth than Frank Barlow. And Spivey is a motorcycle guy all year long. Tougher than whale leather, as they say. And so, all you have to do is wait another year. This year, you can forget it. You're not going to be able to, you know, you could question them and say, where were you? But that only alerts them to the fact that they're being surveilled. So, what Norval agrees with Frank Barlow is that they'll talk a couple times in the coming year, and they'll plan this out together. And so, as you can see, we're closing in on our killers.
The late author James Allen McPherson explained in his legendary fiction writing classes at the University of Iowa how great stories could be boiled down to one statement: this is a story about something essential, quintessential about the human condition. Isaac Babel's short story My First Fee, for example, was about the most basic aspect of a story: the ache to have it heard. We asked Amaria what Hyde River was about, a story that had stopped your host in his tracks as he read in a fever to figure out just what it was these editorial screeners were looking for. But Hyde River stood out, or stood off, more accurately. It reminded us of Bree Steej Pancake Stark's stories of life in the Appalachian Hills. Brees was one of McPherson's mentorees at the Iowa workshop. We mentioned this to Omaria and she told us she had been reading McPherson's story, Gold Coast, while working on Hyde River, but she did not know of Brees's writing. I do know of that family though, she said, from where I grew up. Your host laughed and said the reoccurring image in the story of people waiting in their cars, in some liminal time-space, resonated. At one point in the story the narrator says, Mama was sitting in a car when I got home. The hotter the day is, the more I saw how the people around me like Mama and Vern sat staring through their windshields, burning holes into the earth. Omaria told me for her, Hyde River was about collapse. Here's Omaria.
That summer day, when I still lived with Mama and Vern, I woke up early in the morning to go for a walk around the neighborhood. It was 2007. I was 18 and headed off to college in a few weeks. I planned to study zoology back then. It made sense that I liked to care for animals more than I cared for people, even though we never had a pet in our house. This was the time just before Mama and Vern separated for good, and when my brother Quentin moved back into the house. On the weekends, I worked with Vern at Winner Winner Chicken Dinner. On the weekdays, I walked around the neighborhood or sat on the porch and in my head made up summer vacations that I hadn't had. Trips to the pool, beach barbecues, the salt smell of the Mediterranean Sea. Those daydreams involved Paloma, and the two of us would travel around the world in the summer, swimming in all the world's oceans. If I wished long enough to be away from Hyde River Road, my dreams would turn into the blue of the ocean. I swear I dreamt of water all summer, and to this day, I cannot understand why. During that time of year, the sky at dawn gave color to the neighborhood, brightening the faded out greens and pinks of the houses, and the air was cool enough during the early summer mornings that I did not sweat through my hoodie. The only ones up aside from me and the birds were my neighbor's rooster and a few folks who were headed out to work. They would wave to me as I walked. Often they lingered in their cars, letting the engines run until they snapped into autopilot and left the driveway. Squeak crowed at the first sign of sunlight peeking through the sky. I named him that because he made the morning sound like the air was being sucked out of the neighborhood. He was easily seen pacing the top of Jeff's sagging roof just up the road from our house. Jeff was white. He and another white family were the only ones left in the neighborhood. The rest of us were black or brown, and all kinds of black. Bus driver black, school teacher black, post office black, and whatever black Mama and Vern called themselves. The rooster was bright orange with blue feathers, and he had a red bill. It is twisted how nature could make something so small and beautiful like Squeak and give it a loud and horrible crow that could be heard three streets over. There was the usual route that I took, around the road to the apartment complex where the playground was, down the side street where an old manufacturing building still stood. It had one 18-wheeler parked in its dusty lot with grass and dandelions growing around the tires because it hadn't been used in God knows when. We were on the side of town with mismatched houses and deep ditches along the road. Our house sat at the bottom of the hill where rainwater collected in our yard and driveway, creating a muddy pool that never seemed to completely dry up. The laundromat and church shared a building that was right across from the Food Lion. And of course, there was no river. Along this path, where I passed a corner store and up to another section of the neighborhood, I walked around to the Montessori school. The parking lot was empty except for one stray yellow school bus propped up on cinder blocks with its hood up. Here, I could run laps, a big, tall, black girl in a hoodie without the risk of getting hit by a car or worse, being laughed at by the people inside them. I started to jog, and when I came to the back of the school, where the dumpster area met with the woods, Vern's truck was parked in the shade on the other side of the dumpsters. He sat in the shadows, his face hidden so that he looked asleep. I ducked my head and made a U-turn so Vern wouldn't see me. At the edge of the school that turned into the road, a car drove by and slowed down a little. I thought Vern was working all that time he stayed away from the house. which is why I wasn't mad with him at first when he stopped eating dinner with us or coming home at night. I was going to tell Mama. I was going to say that her husband is sleeping in the parking lot up the street and he's not working or contributing, so it's only smart for her to kick him to the curb for good. But I didn't. When I got home, the sun had fully come out, though it hadn't reached down the hill to our house yet, and our porch looked dark and cold. I could see Mama pacing and jangling her car keys in the living room through the window, and somehow it felt wrong to interrupt her. I just sat on the porch, waiting for the sun to reach our end of the neighborhood, and at some point, I lost my nerve to tell. There was a rustling sound coming from around the house. I was thinking it was those rabbits again. We had a family of bunnies that lived in the little Rubbermaid shed Vern built when we first moved in 4 years earlier. There was a box of raisins in my pocket, which was a great snack on my walks, and I thought to bring them over to the rabbits. When I got to the backyard, Squeak was pecking the ground, bringing up little specks of dirt around him. Quentin had climbed on top of the shed, his duffel bag laid on out in the grass. "Demon bird," Quentin's voice was so deep it shook me. It was the first time I had seen my brother in 2 years. He looked so different now, like a grown man, and I didn't know what to say to him. Mama must have picked him up this morning. "What you doing, Squeak?" I said. Squeak stopped pecking and looked at me, 1 foot raised in the air like the roadrunner in Freeze Frame. I tossed a few raisins. He ran off through the trees to the house next door. I started to run after him because he was going the wrong way. His house was across the street. Mama came out the back door in her hospital scrubs and a backpack high on her back, bulging with her entire day inside of it. "They just rabbits, boy," Mama said. "Get from down there." Quentin jumped off the shed and then came over to me and punched my arm. It was awkward because it wanted to be a hug and then a handshake before he settled for a punch. I hit him back, though. Punk. I was older, and he was shorter than me and younger, with a patchy goatee trying to grow in around his mouth. We both looked like our father, who was in prison somewhere further down south than we were. It felt good to see a face like my own rather than like Mama's. "Listen, you and Quentin will be here today, so make sure he eats and showers. Vern working double shift at Reedsville, but he'll pick you up for work later." Mama made it sound like Quentin wasn't 16 years old and that he'd forgotten how to take care of himself while in juvenile detention. I gave Mama a look, but she brushed off some pollen that blew onto her shoulder with a shift in wind. "You burning up in that hoodie, ain't you?" Mama didn't wait for me to answer as she walked back into the house and out the front door. I followed behind, and when I got inside, Mama had already cranked up the car and was backing up out of the driveway, her head spun all the way around, the tires catching smoke and mud as it climbed up the hill. Quentin came inside and set his bag on the couch before running into every room. "We have a computer now?" He said it in almost disbelief, like he was asking, how could we afford such a luxury? The third bedroom had an air mattress and a small television set on the floor. Some of Quentin's clothes were folded up in a laundry basket, and Mama had also put my old blanket in one of my pillows onto the mattress. The house had been preparing for Quentin for days, ready to have a new corner of it occupied. He sat at the computer all morning playing online games with the volume turned all the way up and talking on the phone with friends he hadn't seen in 2 years. My little brother had gone away with 3 pairs of jeans and a few white tees. And those were the only things he brought back with him.
Very, very good.
Yep. There we are.
Well, thank you so much for reading that.
Yeah, my pleasure. I was thinking about how to write brother and sister relationships. You know, I just think like, you know, siblings are really interesting to like think about and like to write about, and how you grow up in the same household, but you could be two different people outside of it, yet have similar things and similar traits and all that. So, yeah.
So where did you go to school?
At the University of Kentucky. I went there in 2017, and it's a 2-year program out there. So I was there for the whole time. And yeah, it was my first time in Kentucky, but I was born and raised in North Carolina. I've been here in Philly for about 2 years after I left the program at UK. I had met some really amazing folks out there in Kentucky, specifically folks who are teaching on staff at UK in the English department and teaching creative writing. Crystal Wilkinson comes to mind. She's an Appalachian poet. Appalachia, if you're familiar, is sort of Black folks who are in Appalachia. It's sort of like a poetry collective, a writing collective. So Crystal Wilkinson was one of my professors and also a mentor and on my chair at UK, and Frank X. Walker is out there. And the program is led by Hannah Batard. And so there are a lot of great writers out in Kentucky. And so it was cool to be among those folks out there. But I had a really good experience. You know, I still talk with a few of the folks that I was in program with to this day. So it was really cool. I graduated in 2019. So it is only 2 years ago, so I still feel like I'm still like fresh in the like graduate world, you know.
So tell me about where you grew up. Was it a city, a town?
I guess in North Carolina is considered a city, although like compared to New York or Philadelphia, it's a very small city. I grew up in a place called High Point, which is most people, I don't know if they know, it's the furniture capital of the world. This is what we're known for. So I grew up there, which is about an hour outside of Raleigh-Durham.
So tell me about the story.
Yeah, so I started writing this story right after I graduated. I had wrote bits and pieces of it a few years ago. But I really started to develop it after I graduated, and it wasn't a part of my thesis or anything, but I started thinking about this character in this specific place during 2007. And I wanted to sort of develop it and see where it goes. And so High River sort of came out of that thought process. And I think that was really, I began writing it in the beginning of 2019. And so a year or so just developing the short story, and I really started to like do edits and revise it in the summer of 2020. So right before I was able to get it published in story. I had been working on this for about a year or so solidly after grad school. Yeah, so the story is set in North Carolina. I don't know if I specifically wrote it in the story, but it's definitely set in North Carolina, and it's sort of loosely based on the home that I spent my teenage years in. And so that's kind of where the elements come from. But I grew up in a working class environment, working class neighborhood, working class family. And so this story kind of draws from that place that I spent the majority of my teenage years in, living with my mom and my stepfather in this house. So a lot of that experience is reflected in High River. But yeah, I grew up in a working class family and a working class sort of town in the South, although we are a city. But there are a lot of like sort of, you call it quote unquote country elements that are in play. My elementary school was like across the street from a farm. My granddaddy worked at a farm, and I remember him bringing us to work with him when I was a small child on this farm. And so a portion of my family is from sort of places outside of the city in North Carolina, like in the deep South, South Carolina, and, you know, in Monroe County in North Carolina. So a lot of that kind of is there in the city that I grew up in, a lot of that history. And so, I think when I was writing this story, I was just thinking about this specific place when I was a teenager that I kind of just was obsessed about, that I like wanted to get down the page and wanted to write about. Where I lived, And we no longer have that house now, but it was a big part of my teenage years, and you know, so important to me. Yeah.
One of the maxims of, it's a cliche now, but the maxims of workshops is often write what you know, which some people sort of poo-poo now, but this story felt like it was lived by the person who wrote it, you know? I mean, in one sense or another. And that's what every writer strives to do, to get that sense of place, that sense of atmosphere of a place, you know, that is so lacking in our modern world. You know what I mean? And so many times it's in our childhoods, you know. It may not literally be your childhood, but you know what I mean. Just the sense of the place and those characters just came across so thoroughly in this story that it was amazing. What are you working on now? Are you working on a book of short stories, or are you sending some more stories out to be published, or what's happening in that sense?
So right now I've been working on a novel, and I'm working on writing about this family, this specific family in a fictional town of North Carolina, and sort of thinking about where that family has come from and sort of where they are presently and in the future. And so I'm going back in time for this one. And I've been working on this novel since 2019. So it's still like a work in progress, but that's kind of like the main thing that I'm working on right now. And I just recently started writing another short story, because after summer 2020, I hadn't really been able to sort of write another story. Had that, I don't know what you call it, like spark or like attention span or like energy to like write another story. So I hadn't written any other stories since this was published last year. But I just started working on another one. So I'm really excited about this and sort of seeing where it goes. But
that's exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, since you were in Story Magazine, are you getting contacted by agents and stuff like that? Or do you already have an agent?
No, I don't have an agent yet. Not being contacted by anybody. Just writing and working and trying to sort of still like working on this voice and what I want to say and practicing and journaling and all of that. Yeah.
Okay. Journaling. Wonderful. And I saw that maybe there were some other stories that are online. Was that your thesis that is online? Do you think any of those stories that you'll pick those back up to maybe use one as it is, or develop them further into a book of short stories, or even use them in your novel?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. The thesis that I wrote is a collection of short stories. And quite a few of those stories that I wrote are sort of based in the South, in North Carolina, kind of that environment that I grew up in. One of the stories, Blood Sisters on the Ghost Train, was published in the anthology of Appalachian writers. And the other ones I haven't really worked on since graduating. But I definitely do see a lot of what I wrote and a lot of the elements and a lot of the atmosphere that I wrote and that collection sort of being brought into my novel and my other writing. And at this point, I don't know what I'm going to do with those stories. I would love for it to become a collection and to sort of think about how I would fit other stories into this or how it would fit into the stories that I'm writing now. But yeah, I think a lot of that is kind of like, it's seeping into my newer work, if that makes sense.
And you said you're working now. What is your occupation?
I work for a nonprofit foundation called the Groundswell Fund. And it's a foundation that funds reproductive justice organizations and the reproductive justice movement here in the United States that are mainly led by women of color and trans and queer people of color. And I'm the communications manager. I create stories. I manage their social media platforms. I write emails. And I talk about the exciting work that their grantees do. Yeah.
Well, that's great. Great work to be doing. And that's full time?
Yeah, that's full time. It's, it's a 9 to 5 basically, but it's remote. So I get to work from home, which is nice. Yeah.
Well, that's good. Yeah. The thing I wanted to mention about McPherson, one of the things that he stressed about stories was kind of how he would approach a story from the point of view of it being like a quintessential statement about some aspect of life, almost like a snapshot. He would like boil each story down to, and this is a story about this. Do you think your story is about anything quintessential about life, or is it more broad ranging, more expansive?
I think when I started looking at it and writing it and understanding what I wanted to say, I was thinking about collapse, and I was trying to capture what collapse looks like for these people in this community by sort of honing in onto this teenager who has one foot in this working class environment, but is about to head off into college, presumably going into a different environment and maybe meeting people who she didn't grow up with or who didn't grow up in the same communities or neighborhoods that she was raised in. And so I was thinking about collapse, and I think I wanted to put it in 2007 because it was the year before the financial collapse. And so I kind of wanted to sort of capture that environment during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like the main thing on my mind. It's like thinking about folks who have been told their entire life to try hard and work hard and then eventually you succeed, but not seeing any of the benefits, not seeing that success, sort of like seeing the lie being exposed as things fall apart. That's what I was thinking about when I was writing this. And so I guess it was a snapshot for me, a snapshot of this particular summer before everything kind of crashes or before something is discovered or something is exposed. So that's kind of how I approach this story. And
okay, that's wonderful.
I don't think I approach every story with that. Yeah, yeah. But this one, I was specifically thinking about that and, also thinking about what it is to be a teenager, wanting to write about being a teenager too.
Thank you for joining us for Serial City number 9. Join us next time for Serial City.